Welcome everybody. This is the sixth lecture in our course on women in Indian Buddhism, organized by the Numata Center of Buddhist Studies and the Women in Buddhism Studies Initiative at the University of Hamburg. And today it is my great pleasure to welcome Raiko Onuma, who will speak to us on the topic of the Bad Nun, Tulananda in Pali canonical and commentarial sources. Raiko Onuma is an associate professor in the Department of Religion at Dartmouth College in the United States, where she has been teaching courses on Buddhism, Hinduism, and religious studies since 1999. Her research focuses on Sanskrit and Pali Buddhist literature, especially narrative literature, and she is the author of two books, one called Head, Eyes, Flesh and Blood, Giving Away the Body in Indian Buddhist Literature, and another called Ties That Bind, Maternal Imagery and Discourse in Indian Buddhism. She is currently working on her third book, which will be about animals in the Indian Buddhist imagination. So much for introduction, and now I hand over to Raiko Onuma.
Okay, well, thank you, Venerable Analeo, for that kind introduction, and thank you for inviting me to be part of this series. I've never lectured in this format before. It's a little bit awkward, and I apologize for the very drab background behind me. I'm up here in my little home. I have been listening to all of the lectures so far and finding them quite wonderful and have been learning a lot myself. So thank you to all of the previous lectures. I think I'd like to follow your example, giving my lecture and asking you all to hold your questions and comments until the end. And I will leave plenty of time at the end for those questions and comments. So I thought I would start by saying just a few words to put my lecture into the context of the ones that you've already heard. So far, the focus of the course has been on attitudes toward women, as well as some glimpses of women's own agency in Buddhist writings from India, and especially in texts of the Vinaya genre. But for the most part, we have been looking at women in general or women as a group. So what I want to do today is look at one particular woman, or rather one particular female character. And that is, of course, the famous, or should we say infamous, nun Tulananda in Pali, whose name might be translated as something like Fat Joy. I sort of like to imagine her as a chubby, rosy-cheeked, very loud nun. And when I say that I'm focusing on her as a female character rather than as a woman, this is indicative of the approach that I most often take in my own work towards Buddhist texts in India. So a couple of weeks ago, Amy Langenberg gave a lecture on female agency in two Sanskrit Vinayas. And in her lecture, she very usefully went over these three interpretive modes that one might take in their approach to Buddhist literature, especially texts of the Vinaya genre. And I am borrowing but also slightly abbreviating her slide here. So one approach is to read these texts as literary products of a certain gendered worldview. A second approach is to read these texts as normative statements about ethical ideals. And a third approach is to read these texts as records of custom. And of course, the three approaches are not mutually exclusive. They can be combined and intertwined with each other. In her lecture, I actually found the third one really interesting, you know, the most interesting of all. But as I thought about these three modes in relation to my own work on Tulananda and really my work in general, it became clear to me that I most often read Buddhist literature through the first interpretive mode. In other words, I see Buddhist texts, even texts of the Vinaya genre, as literary products first and foremost. And when it comes to particular individual characters who appear in these texts, I pretty much never assume that they are historical in nature. They might have a historical kernel or be based on an actual historical person, but as they appear in the text, it seems to me that they are always already constructed as literary characters who are fulfilling certain functions within Buddhist discourse. So, for example, if you think about a character like Ananda, who is such a wonderful character that everybody seems to love, to me it seems clear that one of the basic purposes of his character within the world of Buddhist discourse is to humanize our image of the Buddhist monk. You know, Ananda is warm and he's sweet and friendly and he likes women and he feels sorry for the nuns and he's very, very, very attached to the Buddha. On the other hand, he also has certain very relatable human weaknesses. Sometimes he's a bit slow. Sometimes he makes mistakes. He is the very last to succeed in attaining nirvana. So in all these ways, he's just a very relatable and attractive figure. And I think that his character has been intentionally constructed as a kind of humanizing image of the monk. You know, one of the things that's so fascinating to me as a scholar is that Buddhist literature presumably has been composed by many different people in many different places, working over hundreds and hundreds of years of time. And yet we find that different characters and themes and narrative motifs do have a sort of coherence about them. And they're not completely random, which to me is sort of amazing. So this is my approach to Ananda. I don't think there was really a specific historical nun who did all of these bad things. I think that she is a literary character, and she has been constructed to fulfill certain functions. And today I'm going to be putting forth three arguments about some of the functions that I think Tulananda is fulfilling. Okay, so with that as an introduction, let's just go over a bit of basic background information about Tulananda. So her name is Tulananda in Pali and Stulananda in Sanskrit. I should make it clear that what I'm talking about today is pretty much limited to Theravada sources in Pali. Stulananda also appears very extensively in Sanskrit and Chinese Vinaya sources, especially in the Mula Sarvastivada Vinaya. But I have not looked at those traditions closely. So my focus today is largely limited to sources in Pali, although I will include a few minor comments about Stulananda in the Mula Sarvastivada Vinaya, drawing on the work of other scholars. I wanted to mention that Dumcho Diana Finnegan, Gregory Chopin, Shane Clark, as well as Amy Langenberg, have all written bits and pieces about Stulananda in the MSV, although it would really be great to see somebody do a fuller treatment of her character in that Vinaya, as well as in others. In any case, Tulananda is famous, of course, for being a misbehaving nun. In fact, it is her persistent bad behavior that is responsible for the promulgation of many rules in the Bhikkhuni Patimokkha, which is the list of disciplinary rules incumbent upon all nuns. She is more responsible for the establishment of those rules than any other individually named nun. So as you can see on the slide here, by my count in the Pali Vinaya, it is her misbehavior that is directly responsible for the promulgation of 2 Parajika rules, 4 Sangadisesa rules, 7 Nisagya Pachatiya rules, and 24 Pachatiya rules. And this constitutes a pretty impressive 12% of all the rules incumbent upon nuns. and an even more impressive 28% of all rules that are unique to nuns and not shared in common with monks, which are the only rules that are explicitly treated in the nuns section of the Pali Vinaya. So, you know, clearly she's not a good nun. She's a bad nun who does a lot of things that nuns should not do. We might also note that no Buddhist source, as far as I'm aware of, ever mentions her attainment of nirvana or any other level of spiritual progress. In fact, according to the Samyutta Nikaya, she eventually fell away from the religious life. And according to the Sanskrit Mahavastu of the Mahasanghika Lokottaravada school, she fell down dead after having an argument with Mahakashyapa and was immediately reborn in hell. So, you know, we could say that she is a bad nun in terms of both Dharma and also Vinaya. On the other hand, however, what makes her such an intriguing character is that these very same sources also describe her as a nun who excels in both Dharma and Vinaya. So in terms of Dharma, the origin stories for seven different rules, in other words, the same context that is describing all of these misbehaviors, also tell us, using the same sentence over and over again, that the nun Tulananda was very learned, she was an experienced preacher, and she was skilled at speaking of Dhamma. Therefore, one origin story goes on to tell us many people attended to the nun Tulananda. Moreover, in two more origin stories, she even preaches to King Pasanadi of Kosala, which must have been an enormous privilege for a nun to be able to preach to the king himself. And the king, being instructed, roused, excited, and gladdened by her preaching, rewards her with very expensive gifts. And finally, I will also mention that in the MSV, the Mula Sarvastivada Vinaya, she is described as one who knows the Tripitaka. In other words, the entirety of Buddhist canonical writings. So these are unusual descriptions for a nun. Not many nuns are described in this way, and clearly she's being depicted here as an extremely learned and talented nun when it comes to her knowledge of the Dharma. Likewise, we also find plenty of evidence that she excels in matters of Vinaya. For example, the origin stories for various rules make it clear that she has the seniority and requisite knowledge to act as a preceptor, to ordain her own disciples, and to settle legal questions within the Sangha. And in one of those stories, she criticizes the other nuns for not knowing what a formal act is, or the defect in a formal act, or the failure of a formal act, or the success of a formal act. And she contrasts this with her own knowledge of those things. Of course, the very phrasing of that sentence itself serves to demonstrate her mastery over the highly technical vocabulary of Vinaya literature. And then finally, we can also note that as a result of her mastery of both Dharma and Vinaya, she is clearly a nun who has a public reputation and enjoys a certain amount of esteem among the general public. Without going into details here, I will just note that the origin stories for various rules make it clear that she has her own pupils and followers, that she has no trouble receiving ample alms from householders, and that certain lay families are specifically dedicated to her support. So this is really something of a puzzle. If Tulananda were merely intended to be a depiction of a bad and misbehaving nun, then why would she be depicted with so many signs of success and so many positive qualities? The Indian scholar Meena Taleem, as I mentioned in my article, was so confused by this juxtaposition of contradictory qualities that she concluded that there must have been two nuns named Tullananda, because otherwise how could we make sense of her depiction? I don't think that explanation is very convincing, and that's not the conclusion that I would immediately jump to. In fact, in my approach to reading Buddhist texts, this is the point where I would be driven to conclude not that the texts are just incoherent or random, but rather that there must be something more going on here. There must be a more complex message being conveyed than just showing us what a bad nun looks like. So in my article on Tullananda, which I assign to all of you as reading, but which I don't necessarily assume everyone has read, I spend some time developing an argument to explain this juxtaposition of contradictory qualities. Here I'm just going to kind of cut to the chase and tell you what I think the purpose of this juxtaposition is. So I believe that in the character of Tullananda, there is an intentional contrast being drawn between external trappings on the one hand and internal transformation on the other hand. The ordinary or ideal relationship between these two things is that the former are supposed to lead to the latter, right? I mean, all of the external trappings of Buddhism, whether it's texts or teachings or rituals or monasteries or the monastic institution itself, all of those external trappings are designed to lead to genuine internal transformation. But of course, they don't always do so, and there is no guarantee that they will. And by recognizing that, I think the Buddhist tradition acknowledges its own limitations. And I see Tullananda as a character, one way in which that recognition is made. So in regards to the Vinaya, for example, just because a person adheres to every single already established rule and knows every monastic procedure and masters all of the technical Vinaya vocabulary does not necessarily mean that they have truly internalized the ethical principles upon which the Vinaya is based, or that they have truly cultivated a moral character. There is no guarantee that one leads to the other. And the best way of showing that is by depicting a character who has total mastery over the former, but nothing at all of the latter. And that is Tullananda. She has mastery over the external trappings of Buddhist monastic discipline, but that doesn't mean she's an ethical person. In fact, it may even be the case that having mastery over the external trappings allows her to manipulate them for the purpose of behaving unethically. One of the basic features of Vinaya literature that many people have commented upon is the fact that it doesn't lay down general ethical principles. Instead, it lays down very specific rules of behavior. And those rules of behavior, or at least many of them, may ultimately be based on ethical principles, but they are not the ethical principles themselves. And as a result of that, every time a new behavior comes up that violates the underlying principle, the Buddha has to promulgate yet another rule of monastic discipline prohibiting that specific behavior. So this is what allows monastics like Tullananda, who are well versed in matters of Vinaya, to exploit their knowledge of the rules to their own benefit and advantage. Excuse me. I wanted to mention two other scholars who have made similar observations about kind of misbehaving monastics in general. Mohan Vijayaratna, speaking about both bad monks and bad nuns in the Pali Vinaya, he observes that such monastics never transgress an established rule, but are crafty enough to commit another fault of the same type, all while respecting the established law. And similarly, Gregory Chopin, speaking about the group of six monks who play a role similar to that of Tulananda, he observes that in spite of their obviously bad behavior, they are almost always technically correct in their shenanigans. So all of these figures are clever and crafty manipulators of monastic law rather than just straightforward violators. All of them adhere to the letter of the law, but not to its spirit. And therefore, I think they have the serious function of showing that those two things are not necessarily the same. So, I'm going to kind of sum up this point by quoting from a great authority, namely myself in my own article. The ability of bad monks and nuns like Tulananda to manipulate their detailed knowledge of monastic discipline in order to engage in unethical behavior, requiring the Buddha to promulgate one new rule after another pertaining to ever more specific situations, seems to be a common theme of Vinaya literature. I would suggest that perhaps this was a way for Vinaya authors not only to illustrate the cleverness of misbehaving monastics, but also to acknowledge the limitations of their own ethical system, its failure to finally capture through a maze of specific rules what it means to lead an ethical life. In this sense, one might argue that bad but Vinaya-savvy monastics such as Tulananda serve a dual function. On the one hand, they illustrate individual faults and bad qualities such as greed. On the other hand, they provide a critical commentary on the limitations of the Vinaya project itself, a subtle acknowledgement that no list of rules, no matter how comprehensive, can ever wholly crystallize the ethical life. Now, of course, exactly the same thing can be said with regard to Tulananda's mastery of the Dharma. Having mastery over the entire Tripitaka, being an excellent preacher, etc., does not necessarily mean that you have taken any of those teachings to heart or let them transform you in any way. And again, the best way to illustrate that is by depicting a figure like Tulananda, who is an expert preacher of the Dharma, who can preach to the king himself, and has thorough knowledge of the canonical texts, and yet who fails to make any spiritual progress at all, and perhaps even ends up being reborn in hell. So again, I will quote this point as well, or really kind of both of these points together, by quoting from myself. Tulananda preaches the Dhamma without internalizing it, and she masters the Vinaya without sharing its underlying motivation. In her case, mastery of the external trappings of both Dhamma and Vinaya is not undergirded by the genuine internal transformation that Dhamma and Vinaya are meant to achieve. This points to a larger conclusion. In spite of the great benefit provided by the Buddha's word, neither Dhamma nor Vinaya themselves finally embody the profound internal transformation he calls for. In the end, they are only external trappings. The Buddha provides human beings with precious resources that can lead one to the ultimate good, yet there is no guarantee that they will have their desired effect. In this sense, far more than just a bad nun, I would suggest that Tulananda becomes an emblem of the limitations of Buddhism itself. So this is, I think, more interesting than just being a bad nun. It's a kind of second order reading of her purpose as a character. The final thing I want to mention in connection with this point before I move on to a second point is that in some of the other Vinayas, and this really doesn't happen so much in the Pali Vinaya, but in some of the other Vinayas, this same point is further reinforced and made even more compelling by the fact that Tulananda doesn't just excel at the external trappings of Buddhist monasticism. She also excels at the external trappings of virtually everything she does. So in the Mula Sarvastivada Vinaya, for example, you have a series of stories about Sthula Nanda setting herself up in various types of businesses. In one story, she starts working as a kind of a fortune teller. In another story, she sets up a tavern. And in another story, she sets up a brothel. And in all three cases, she is wildly successful. The woman is good at everything she does. Likewise, she also excels at the external trappings of being a wife and mother. And of course, that is especially problematic because of the way that it blurs the fundamental distinction between modics and laity upon which the Sangha is dependent. So in one story, for example, she visits a lay household where the woman of the house has just given birth to a baby, but has no idea how to take care of a newborn. And Sthula Nanda immediately takes expert charge of the situation. This is how the text describes it, and I'm borrowing this translation from Dumcho Diana Finnegan's PhD dissertation on gender in the MSV. Sthula Nanda put down her begging bowl, tucked up her clothes. I love that image. There are many times I can imagine her tucking up her robes, tucked up her clothes and took the baby. After rocking him for a little while, she scrubbed him down with soap, rinsed him with lukewarm water, poured medicinal eye drops into his eyes, drew a bindu with soft clay, brushed off his hair, spoon-fed him honey and fresh butter, placed him in the crib, and put him to sleep. Then she instructed the mother to do this every day. She took her parcel home and left. So, you know, she's way better mother than I am. I never did any of this stuff. So she excels at the external trappings of motherhood. She excels at the external trappings of running a business. And she excels at the external trappings of Buddhist monasticism. But none of it is driven by any genuine internal motivations or dispositions or character. In fact, several times in the Mula Sarvastivada Vinaya, Sthula Nanda herself says, or asks rhetorically, is there any craft or art whatsoever about which I have no knowledge? So everything for her is just a craft or an art that she can immediately master and then benefit and profit from. So I think one of the more subtle messages being conveyed by Sthula Nanda's character is a warning to us not to be seduced by external trappings, including those of Buddhism itself, and a message that external trappings are only valuable in as much as they truly reflect something genuine that lies within. Again, a more complicated message than just showing us this is what a bad nun is like. Okay, so that's my first argument. I want to move on now to a second argument or a second kind of conclusion that I have reached about Sthula Nanda. And this one has to do with her favoritism and partiality towards certain people. When you read stories involving Sthula Nanda, it becomes clear that she sees each person as an individual and that she favors certain people over others. So, for example, in various stories, she shows obvious favoritism for Devadatta and his fellow schismatics, for Ananda, for her sister, Sundari Nanda, who is also a nun, for her disciple, Chandakali, and for another misbehaving or suspended monk, Arita. And conversely, she disfavors and does not like certain other people, such as the nun, Buddhakapalani, and the monk, Mahakasapa. And this tendency to like certain people and not like other people, of course, stands in marked contrast to the Buddhist values of equanimity, detachment, and impartiality, which are especially important within the context of Buddhist monasticism. In Buddhist monasticism, you do have a strong idea of having respect for the yellow robe regardless of the individual qualities of the person wearing it. And you also have the idea that all members of the Sangha are interchangeable to some degree. Now, granted, because of the principle of seniority, because of the gender hierarchy between monks and nuns, and because of the special duties that adhere to certain relationships, such as the relationship between a preceptor and his or her disciple, of course, it's true that not everyone in the monastery is equal and that different people should be treated differently. Nevertheless, it seems to me that within these basic categories that people fall into, such as senior monk or preceptor or novice, everyone is presumed to have a certain interchangeability, and relationships within the monastery should not be governed by random and idiosyncratic favoritism and partiality. I think actually one of the most striking features of the Vinaya is the enormous emphasis it places on maintaining harmony within the Sangha. And that harmony is generally established through fair and impartial treatment of everyone, rather than everyone just acting on their individual whims and likes and dislikes. And because Tulananda fails to recognize that, she is depicted as a bad nun. Now, here what is interesting to me is that on the one hand, the stories make it very clear that Tulananda is wrong when she shows this favoritism, and that her behavior leads to all kinds of negative consequences that cannot be tolerated. But on the other hand, some of these stories, I think, seem to paint her in a pretty sympathetic light and almost seem to suggest that her loyalty to certain people is understandable and maybe even admirable. And so here, I think what is going on is that her character is being used to acknowledge the compelling nature of ordinary human emotions and the compelling nature of the fact that we do like certain people more than we like others. If you think about it, this is sort of one of my bailiwicks or one of the things that I've always kind of grappled with. The Buddhist emphasis on equanimity and impartiality and treating all living beings alike is actually very unnatural, and its consequences can be very disturbing. It's one of those things that sounds great on the surface, but when you think it through, it can be rather disturbing. If you think, for example, of the Jataka of the Buddha's previous life as Prince Vaisantara, I think in that story it becomes very disturbing when Prince Vaisantara agrees to give his own children away to the evil Brahmin who wants to turn them into slaves because he's a bodhisattva who has universal compassion for everyone, including this evil Brahmin. I think that story, especially in the Pali version, is kind of intentionally shocking. And it is really trying to show you the unnaturalness of what Buddhism is calling for. Somebody once said, or I read somewhere, and unfortunately I can't remember now where, but somebody said once that every transcendental ideology, in other words, every ideology that looks to something transcendent or something that lies beyond this world, must on some level be offensive to ordinary worldly values. Not just different from ordinary worldly values, but actually outright offensive to them. In order to show the seriousness of what that ideology is really calling for. And I think you see that offensiveness in the story of Prince Vaisantara when he is willing to give away the crying and begging children. You know, you sort of have to take seriously what it means to have to be a bodhisattva who has universal compassion. So anyway, I think something vaguely similar is going on with Tulananda, although obviously on a much smaller scale. Certain stories about her seem to take her individual attachments and personal loyalty seriously, for at least an instant. So let's look briefly at two of these stories, and hopefully you'll see what I mean, and I'm not just imagining all of this. Okay, so in the origin story for Sanghadisesa 4, what happens is that Tuananda's own disciple, the nun Chandakali, is described as a quarrelsome nun who is constantly causing trouble within the Sangha. But whenever the other nuns try to discipline her, Tuananda finds some way to prevent it. So one day, when Tuananda is away, her nuns sent by her absence to suspend Chandakali from the order. When Tuananda returns to the nunnery, she wonders why Chandakali is not standing up to greet her. And this is the exchange that takes place between them. Chandakali says, "It is because I am without a protector." And Tuananda asks, "But why are you without a protector?" And Chandakali replies, "These nuns, knowing that I was without a protector, that I was not renowned, and that I had no one to speak up for me, suspended me for not acknowledging an offense." And this is what causes Tuananda to sort of fly into a rage and convene her own assembly of nuns to restore Chandakali to full status. Whereupon the Buddha comes along and says, you can't do that. You can't just undo a legal act that others have already carried out. And he promulgates Sanghadisesa 4 to that effect. Okay, so, I admit that this is pretty subtle and maybe a bit under the surface, but I think the language here is sympathetic toward both women. They are emotionally tied to each other. Chandakali feels helpless because Tuananda was not there to protect her. Tuananda feels angry because these other nuns have essentially gone behind her back to suspend her disciples. So she's going to stick up for Chandakali out of loyalty. And for just an instant, I think the story takes their emotions seriously before having the Buddha come along and prohibit this kind of behavior. Because, of course, as compelling as this kind of fierce loyalty may be, it cannot be tolerated in the monastery if it has the effect of ruining the Sangha's harmony. So here I would almost see Tuananda as a kind of embodiment of ordinary worldly emotions and the compelling power that those emotions can exert. I think this perhaps becomes even clearer in my second example. This is the origin story for Parajika 2. So what happens here is that the nun Sundari Nanda, who is Tulananda's own sister, so now we have biological and familial ties coming into the mix, she becomes pregnant and leaves the order to give birth. When the other nuns wonder whether she became pregnant after becoming a nun, Tuananda tells them that she did. And then this is the exchange that takes place. The nuns say, "But knowing that another nun had become guilty of a parajika offense, that is, the offense of sexual misconduct, why didn't you rebuke her yourself or tell others about it?" And Tuananda replies, "Whatever is a fault for her is also a fault for me. Whatever is infamy for her is also infamy for me. Whatever is disgrace for her is also disgrace for me. Whatever is loss for her is also loss for me. Why would I tell others about my own fault, infamy, disgrace, and loss?" And this eventually leads to the Buddha promulgating Parajika 2, which is that if a nun knowingly conceals another nun's parajika offense, this concealment itself also constitutes a parajika offense. So here, I think that there are several different ways to read Tuananda's statement, whatever is a fault for her, etc. I think if you wanted to read it cynically, it could just suggest that Tuananda does not wish to be tainted by her sister's guilty conduct, and she knows that because they are sisters, she probably will be. So she's trying to distance herself and avoid the situation altogether by just not telling the other nuns. I would prefer to read her statement in another way, and that is as a highly emotional plea in defense of the sisterly bond. You know, look, we're sisters. Her guilt is my guilt. And that's why I just couldn't say anything. I'm human. What do you want from me? And if we read her statement in that way, or even with just a hint of that suggestion, then I think once again, the story, just for an instant, is taking those emotions seriously before having the Buddha come along to explain why that kind of favoritism cannot be tolerated. I might also add here that we also learn in one of the Jatakas, the Suvanahamsa Jataka, that in a previous lifetime, Tulananda was the mother of Sundari Nanda. And in that lifetime, when both mother and daughter were reduced to a state of poverty, Tulananda engaged in an act of greed that came to no good. But again, in that story, you can at least get a sense that maybe she was driven to her misbehavior by her motherly protectiveness for her daughter and her daughter's welfare, just as in this lifetime, she is driven to her misbehavior by her sisterly bond with Sundari Nanda. So, again, I will sum up this point by quoting briefly from myself. The ties of loyalty Tulananda feels towards specific others, such as her sister, always outweigh the imperatives posed by monastic regulations intended for the generic all. Once again, Tulananda becomes a highly relatable figure who stakes a claim for the importance of worldly and familial emotions, even as her behavior comes to define a serious monastic offense. Okay, so that's my second argument. I will move on to my third and final argument concerning Tulananda. And so far I haven't really said anything about gender, even though this course focuses on gender. The first two points I've made about Tulananda are not explicitly tied to her gender, although they might implicitly be. But the third one is. So a couple of weeks ago, Amy Langenberg briefly referred to Tulananda as a kind of proto-feminist. And this is the argument that I want to try to flesh out here. It seems to me that there are a number of stories in which Tulananda seems to get into trouble primarily for her insistence on defending the rights of women and refusing to show the proper deference toward powerful men. And maybe you could even speculate that this is how she became labeled as the bad nun in the first place. Perhaps there was a specific historical nun who was always sticking up for the women, and then her name became a convenient marker for all misbehaviors in general. Of course, that's not something you could ever prove, but it is interesting to speculate. So let's look at two of these stories. The first one is the origin story for Sangha di Sesa 1, which is a bit long, but I think worth looking at in full. And I've merely summarized it here. So what happens in this story is that a faithful Buddhist layman donates a shed to the order of nuns. After he dies, his son, who is not a follower of the Buddha, decides that the shed belongs to him, forcibly repossesses it, and orders the nuns to vacate. Tulananda immediately objects. "No, sir, don't say that. This shed was given to the order of nuns by your father." The dispute is brought before the ministers of justice, who of course are powerful men, who seem uninterested in dealing with it. "Ladies, who knows whether or not this shed was given to the order of nuns?" Again, Tulananda objects, reminding the ministers of the legal transfer of the shed. "But didn't you yourselves see, hear, and arrange witnesses for the gift of the shed?" The ministers of justice, realizing that the lady has spoken truly, award the shed to the nuns. The son becomes angry and reviles the nuns, calling them shaven-headed whores. Tulananda reports this abuse to the ministers of justice, which leads to the son being punished. Angered yet further, he then persuades a group of non-Buddhist ascetics, again men, to verbally harass the nuns. Again, Tulananda turns him in to the ministers of justice, and this time the son is locked up. Men, the text specifies, not people, but men, become critical of the nuns. First, the nuns allowed this shed to be stolen away from that son. Second, they had him punished. Third, they had him locked up. Pretty soon, they will have him killed. In response to this criticism, the Buddha promulgates Sanghadisesa 4. If a nun speaks with envy about a householder's son, a slave, a servant, or even a recluse who has gone forth, all male gendered nouns, this nun has become guilty of an offense. Okay, so here, it seems pretty clear to me that the problem with Tulananda's behavior has nothing to do with the rightness or wrongness of her claims. In fact, the ministers of justice rule in her favor three times in a row. Instead, the problem with her behavior is that she insists on defending the rights of women to such an extent that she fails to show the proper deference toward men. And I think that gendered aspect of the story even becomes quite explicit in the Buddha's formulation of the rule, where he prohibits nuns from speaking with envy, not just about anyone, but about men in particular, whether they are householders, sons, slaves, servants, etc. All of the nouns are male gender. Notice also that there isn't even really in this story any attempt to depict Tulananda very negatively. She's not abusive. She doesn't engage in name-calling or foolishness. She seems to be speaking rather calmly, but her behavior is still intolerable. So this is one example of possibly reading Tulananda as a kind of proto-feminist, someone who is insistent on women receiving their due. Okay, my second example of this is the origin story for Sanghadisesa 2. This one is a little bit more problematic, but I think it can still be read in the same light. So it goes like this. In Vaisali, a certain Lichavi man had a wife who committed adultery. The man said to his wife, "Please stop doing this or I will harm you." But even though he said this, she didn't take it to heart. The man then goes to a council of male Lichavi elders and says, "Gentlemen, give me permission over one woman." They ask, "Who is she?" He says, "My wife. She has committed adultery. I will kill her." They reply, "Go ahead." Then the wife heard that her husband wished to kill her. Taking her most valuable possessions, she went to Savati, approached the heretics, and asked to be ordained. The heretics did not want to ordain her. She approached the nuns and asked to be ordained. The nuns did not want to ordain her. She approached the nun Tulananda, showed her the possessions, and asked to be ordained. The nun Tulananda took her possessions and ordained her. Then the husband finds out that his wife has become a nun. He goes to the king and he asks to be given power over her, but the king says that once somebody has joined the Sangha, this is impossible. Then the Lichavi husband became annoyed, irritated, and angry. How can the nuns allow a female thief to be ordained? And this eventually leads the Buddha to promulgate Sanghadisesa 2. If a nun knowingly ordains a female thief who has been caught and sentenced to death without getting permission from the king, the order, a corporation, or a guild, this nun has become guilty of an offense. Okay, so this is obviously a more complicated case. Of course, you could say that the problem with Tulananda's behavior was that she ordained this woman out of greed for the woman's possessions. Those possessions had been stolen from the husband, and obviously nuns should not be doing this. But what I want you to notice with this next slide is how sort of awkwardly the whole matter of the possessions is inserted into the story. In the early part of the story, the possessions are mentioned only briefly here and there, and it would be very easy to take out those mentions and still have a story that makes perfect sense. And then what's odd in the later part of the story is that there it is the wife's adultery that seems to be completely forgotten. So, for example, when the husband becomes angry and says, "How can the nuns allow a female thief to be ordained?" he almost seems to have forgotten that the entire reason he was going to kill her in the first place was for committing adultery and not for stealing. And then even stranger is the Buddhist formulation of the resulting rule. If a nun knowingly ordains a female thief who has been caught and sentenced to death, you know, but of course she hasn't been sentenced to death for stealing. She has been sentenced to death for committing adultery. And in fact, that happens even before she stole anything. So the whole matter of the possessions here, which are the sole element that, you know, fit in with Tulananda's misbehaving nun character, is rather awkwardly inserted. And this even compelled I.B. Horner, the translator of the Pali Vinaya, to append a footnote to this story, where she says, "The Lachavi husband appears to lose sight of his wife's original sin in his effort to recover the property." So she, too, was trying to make sense of how the story is put together. So although it's difficult to know exactly what to make of this story, I would suggest that submerged underneath the story as it has come down to us is another possible story, and that is a story in which Tulananda is trying to save the life of a woman whose husband is going to kill her for committing adultery and who has received permission to do so from a council of powerful male elders. And the other women in the story are too afraid to do anything, but Tulananda is not. The Buddha, however, understandably, not wanting his Sangha to get mixed up in such matters, prohibits what she has done. Again, that is not exactly the story that we have here, but I think it's a possible reading of the story that we do have. Okay. My third piece of evidence for seeing Tulananda as a kind of proto-feminist is the favoritism she shows for Ananda coupled with her dislike of the monk Mahakasapa. And here I won't bother going into a lot of detail, but Ananda, as we all know, is the champion of women. It was his intervention on behalf of women that convinced the Buddha to establish an order of nuns in the first place. And throughout Buddhist literature, he is depicted as always being sympathetic to the nuns and also as being a favorite of the nuns. Conversely, there are several contexts in which Mahakasapa, who is a rather austere figure to begin with, shows some hostility toward the nuns. In one discourse, for example, he refuses to go preach to them until he has been asked three times to do so. We also have some evidence in accounts surrounding the First Council of hostility between Ananda and Mahakasapa over the issue of women. So Oscar von Hinüber, for example, has concluded that Ananda, as a character, stands for the pro-Bhikkhuni faction and Mahakasapa for his opponent. And so, inasmuch as Tulananda favors Ananda and dislikes Mahakasapa, we could also argue that she, too, is a sort of pro-woman, pro-nun stance, which I think goes along quite nicely with her very strong, independent, and also very capable character. Okay, and then finally, I have one last piece of evidence in support of seeing Tulananda as a proto-feminist, although this one, frankly, is really difficult for me to evaluate. I really don't know what to make of it. But in certain passages, Tulananda is described with the phrase, Anyatarasa kulasa kulupika. And this is usually translated, one who relies upon a certain family for alms, meaning that certain lay families are dedicated to Tulananda's support. Anyway, I came across a pretty complicated article on different kinds of genealogical terms in Sanskrit and Pali, written by an Indian scholar named Sharad Patil. And in this article, he argues that the term Kalupika actually derives from a much older term, Kulapa, which he says refers to the female head and head priestess of a matrilineal clan. So according to him, this was a kind of alternative family structure that existed in certain communities in India at some point in time, and it left its traces on the Sanskrit and Pali languages in terms like Kalupika. And he actually mentions Tulananda as an example. He thinks that the Tulananda that we find in Buddhist sources is a kind of distant memory of such a woman. Again, the argument was super long and complicated, and I have no idea how to evaluate it, but I certainly find it interesting to wonder whether her character could have been based on some kind of matrilineal clan leader, head priestess sort of figure. Okay, so that's my third argument, and I'm now going to begin to wrap things up here by summarizing the three arguments I've made, but also saying just a little bit about my approach to reading Buddhist texts, especially when those texts are about women. So my first point was that Tulananda's character is used to illustrate the difference between external trappings and internal motivations, dispositions, or transformation, showing that the former do not necessarily lead to or imply the latter. And of course, that goes for the external trappings of Buddhism as well. Second point was that Tulananda's character is used to give credit to the compelling nature of ordinary worldly emotions, such as favoritism and partiality, even though they violate the Buddhist values of equanimity, detachment, and impartiality, and cause problems within a monastic context. By the way, I did say that that neither of those arguments was gendered. I do think the second one has a gender element to it, that, you know, women are associated with emotions, etc. The third point was that Tulananda might be seen as a proto-feminist who sometimes gets into trouble for stubbornly defending the rights of women and failing to show the proper deference toward powerful men. And in all of these ways, she is a far more complicated figure than just the prototypical bad nun. In fact, one of the ways that I describe her in my article is by saying that every serious vision of life needs to have a worthy opponent, not a weak or straightforward opponent, but a worthy opponent, a compelling opponent. And I think Buddhism, you know, well, it has many compelling opponents, but one of them is Tulananda. And part of what makes her compelling as an opponent of certain Buddhist values is the fact that she's super talented and skillful and clever and good at everything she does. So those are my three arguments. One final point I wanted to make about all three of them is that, of course, none of them are made explicit in the texts themselves. In fact, even though we have many stories involving Tulananda, the actual passages in which she appears are really quite brief. At least in the Pali Vinaya, they're quite brief, and nothing really explicit or elaborate is said about her character. So these are arguments that are not obvious from just a straightforward reading of the text. And if I had to describe my method of sort of extracting these arguments from the Pali Vinaya, I would describe it as an interpretive approach that is sometimes referred to as reading between the lines or reading against the grain. In other words, being willing to go beyond the surface message of the text and to probe and challenge the text to see some underlying reality that is present but that the author is not explicitly conveying. Obviously, this kind of interpretive strategy is risky. It can go wrong in all kinds of spectacular ways. And I have sometimes been criticized myself for engaging in it too recklessly. But I think it's an especially important strategy when we are reading about women. If we presume, as I do, that virtually all Buddhist texts from India, with the possible exception of the Terigata, were composed, passed down, controlled, and codified by men, then they obviously are not capturing women's voices or women's experiences. But the fact of the matter is, and what I try to remind myself repeatedly, is that these men lived their lives in the company of women. Even if they were monks, they grew up with mothers and sisters and aunts and grandmothers. They had some interactions with the nuns. They likely had a fair amount of interaction with Buddhist laywomen. And, you know, no man can really seal himself in some kind of hermetically sealed patriarchal bubble. So in my opinion, you know, we should read these texts with a sense of optimism and believe that something genuine about women's reality and experience is slipping through, even in the case of a thoroughly negative depiction or mostly negative depiction like that of Tulananda. And I think it is worth the risk of being wrong to go ahead and read between the lines, read against the grain, challenge the text to reveal something about women, and even in some cases speculate wildly about what is really going on. One reason I think it is worth it is so that you don't get depressed by the misogynistic nature of Buddhist texts from India. Another reason I think that it is worth it is because, you know, if these texts from ancient India do not speak to you in some kind of personal way or relate some facet of human experience that you can actually imagine for yourself, then I'm not sure what the point of reading them would be. Reading is always a matter of allowing the world of the text, no matter how far away it is in time and distance, to come together, hopefully come together with the world of your own experience. Because otherwise there is no point in reading anything. Okay, so it's not, so we have 25 minutes. So with that note, I'm going to stop talking and thank you for listening. And now I'm going to sit here awkwardly as you type out any questions or comments or insights you might like to share. Thank you. Oh, that was fast. Okay, so, excuse me, Bhikkhu Analayo says, thank you very much for the inspiring lecture. I fully agree on what you summarized under point one in the previous slide. But there was one formulation you used earlier on which I would like to comment, namely, Tulananda becomes an emblem of the limitations of Buddhism itself. I am not sure I would go that far. I think what you have shown very convincingly is that she is an emblem of the limitations of adopting outer behavior instead of grasping the essence. That is, I would see her as an illustration of the famous simile of the snake, which illustrates how someone learns the Dharma for the sake of building up an ego, instead of progressing on the path to someone who grasps a poisonous snake by the tail and getting bitten. That is the function of the simile and of Tulananda are not about limitations in the teachings themselves, but rather about going about it in the wrong way. Okay, so I would agree, maybe not an emblem of the limitations of Buddhism itself, except for the I guess it depends on whether, you know, I suppose from a Buddhist perspective, if Buddhism is nothing other than the truth itself, then of course she cannot be an emblem of the limitations of Buddhism. If Buddhism, if you're seeing it historically as a religious tradition that really can only manifest itself in external trappings, unless we're able to get into the heads of enlightened people, maybe, that finally can only manifest itself in external trappings, In that sense, I would see her as an emblem of the limitations of Buddhism itself. In as much as Buddhism as a phenomenon in this world manifests itself through outward things. So, but thank you for that point. I like the comparison to the simile. Okay. Bhikkhuni Dhammadina says, just one detail. At the beginning of the lecture, you mentioned that Ananda was sort of laid back in his attitude to gaining nirvana. However, he is consistently portrayed to have attained sotapatti, nirvana, first stage of awakening, early on in his monastic career upon hearing a sermon by Venerable Puna Matanaputta. Only his full awakening is reported as delayed, so he is not shown to be such a prevaricator after all. Yes, that's true. He's not a total slacker, but I've always really enjoyed the story about, you know, Mahakashyapa actually convening the first council and choosing 499 of the Buddha's senior disciples, everyone except for Ananda, because Ananda has not yet attained the final goal, and Ananda being determined to attain nirvana on that very night. You know, it's not that he's a slacker, but there's something very warm and relatable to his character. And of course, also, I think it's clear, or at least it's suggested, that the reason he cannot make that final step may be because he is so personally attached to the Buddha, and the Buddha is also attached to him. It's a very warm relationship. So you're right. Matanaputta. Okay. It's not, I love that, laid back Ananda. It's not that he's a complete slacker, but that he does have certain human foibles that make him compelling and attractive. Thank you for that point. Thanks to you. Anyone else have questions, comments, or insights? Somebody's typing. Regarding the formalism of the Vinaya versus its lack of inherent laid out moral value, the point you made is interesting and important, trappings, etc. At the same time, morally speaking, the Vinaya is based on the five basic moral precepts with celibacy and expanded refined. So it is also difficult to separate the fundamentals of Buddhist ethics from Vinaya. Yes, you're right. That's definitely true. The moral precepts have, more of the ethical sense to them than the very specific rules of behavior that we find in the Vinaya. Nevertheless, I guess what I'm trying to get at is, you know, the authors of the compilers of the Vinaya must have been wrapped up in such a technical and scholastic kind of world and terminology. And I like to think that they also recognized sort of the limitations of their project and of what they were doing, and had certain ways of suggesting that what finally gets to the heart of living an ethical life goes beyond all these rules and these external trappings. And so I'm speculating that Tulananda and other characters like the group of six have something of that purpose. But thank you for that point. Aya Sudama Bhikkhuni, while I don't take Vinaya accounts as literary, nonetheless your interpretation offers beautifully useful ways of seeing these accounts highly relevant to nuns as we ponder and discuss how to live the holy life today. Oh, well, I'm so happy to hear that. I really am. I love Gregory Chopin and his work. I think it's amazing and unbelievable. But the one thing that always did sort of bother me is when he states repeatedly that Vinaya literature in particular is somehow, well, I don't think he really quite means this, but somehow a much more a record of what people were actually doing. Yes, it reflects that, but it's clear that it is literature And especially when you look at its characters, which of course it shares with other varieties of Buddhist discourse, I do think we need to take them as literary texts, and that even somebody who is living the nun's life, if they are able to do that, it can open up all sorts of avenues of interpretation. So thank you for that comment. Bhikkhu Anālayo, it is interesting to consider your comments on Ananda in the light of his function as an emblem for others, in that the course taken by Buddhist monasticism is precisely to follow the lead of Mahakasapa instead, who, in the first Sanghiti account, embodies the opposite of the Ananda faction, and the opposition between the two is of considerable significance for understanding the ambivalence and eventual misogyny of male monastics toward females, especially nuns. So I wonder what you mean by the course taken by Buddhist monasticism is to follow the lead of Mahakasapa. I suppose you mean in terms of the order of nuns dying out and certain Buddhist monastics being resistant to reestablishing it, maybe. But yeah, Ananda, too, of course, you know, again, I'm interested in how women don't just stand for women. They also stand for all kinds of emotions and emotional warmth. And Ananda is like that, too. I love that passage. I can't remember where the passage is from, but Ananda refers to himself as a foolish, womanish man. Attitudes towards nuns and rules and asceticism. Yes, that's true. Yeah, maybe we need more of the Ananda faction. Of course, he's also very much depicted not as the ascetic monk who's out in the wilderness doing all these difficult ascetic deeds, but very much as he seems to always, of course, because he's the Buddha's attendant, he's always sort of in the mix of things, and he's serving as a mediator between the Buddha and the public, and between the Buddha and other monks and nuns and lay people. So he's a very social figure, a kind of social face of Buddhism. Thank you. Anyone else have a question or a comment? Anagarika Michelle Raymond, the Buddha saying, she is not able to convert those who have no faith or increase the faith of those who have faith, doesn't seem to match with the notes of Tulananda's competence in teaching Dhamma and Vinaya. Is this pointing to the fallout and dissatisfaction that arises and perhaps overrides her teaching and leads to the need for new moral rules, or is the discrepancy showing that one or the other of these texts is a later insertion into the canon? That's a very interesting question. She is not able to remember. I do remember that passage. Yeah, well, I mean, maybe it shows that, you know, being a great teacher it finally goes beyond just the words that are coming out of your mouth, right? She is this expert preacher, and she inspires and rouses the king himself, and yet she is not able to convert those. Yeah, I think it suggests both. Maybe no matter how good of a preacher she is, as long as she keeps misbehaving in these ways and violating these ethical principles, then her example, the moral example she sets, will not convert those who have no faith or increase the faith of those who have faith. But perhaps even on top of that, her preaching itself is ineffective because there's not something genuine lying behind it. You know, you think there's so many stories in Buddhist literature of the Buddha himself, of course, but also monks who are able to convert people or allow people to have spiritual progress just by who they are, just by catching a glimpse of them, just by their demeanor, right? So that the teaching in words isn't even necessarily necessary. So I guess maybe the flip side of that would be maybe somebody's really clever with words and an expert preacher, but if there is not that demeanor, genuine demeanor lying behind it, then it will not be effective. Thanks for that interesting question. Oh, Liz is typing. Hi, Liz. Speaking of matters of demeanor, do you have any comments on the attribution of stoutness to this nun? Well, one of the things I talk about in my article is that one of her basic faults does seem to be greed. She's very greedy for all kinds of things, both for herself and also for her disciples. She's greedy for fame and requisites and things and also food. And so I think I presume that the stoutness is maybe merely an indicator that this is someone who wants more than her fair share. Also, it's just funny to think of a fat nun, right? I think there's an element of humor in it as well. And of course, fat joy suggests, you know, that she takes pleasure in getting more than her fair share. Okay, Bhikkhu Anālayo says, regarding the comment by Michelle, I just checked the passage, and that is about her being mahicha, greedy, and that therefore she is not able to inspire others. I also think we need to introduce a historical perspective that tales and comments in the Jataka commentary are, quote, late. In fact, relating back to something you said earlier, I am not sure if we can take the Visantara Jataka as representative of Buddhist thought. As we know, most Jatakas are simply taken over from the common Indian lore and only have a very slim relation to early Buddhist thought simply by dint of one protagonist being identified as a former life of the Buddha. As far as I understand, in early Buddhist thought, the position of equanimity needs to be appreciated as part of the four Brahma Viharas, so that from that viewpoint of the situation you mentioned in the Visantara Jataka could in fact not be a product of genuine early Buddhist imagination. Well, that's interesting. I don't know if I agree. Do you think from a Buddhist perspective, Visantara should have saved his children and told the donor, you know, he's trying to fulfill the perfection of generosity? To me, the Visantara Jataka is actually a very Buddhist Jataka. It's not like, you know, if you look at the Pali Jataka collection, there are so many things that sort of read like Aesop's fables or whatever part of the common Indian lore, as you state. I don't see the Visantara Jataka in that category. I think of it as a very, very Buddhist story. And of course, it's the rebirth that the Buddha remembers on the night of his enlightenment that allows him to overcome Mara. So in my opinion, that story, maybe in an overly shocking way or a way that's meant to jar you, is trying to get you to grapple with things like your attachment to your own children. And what is at stake or what you have to lose when if you're going for the ultimate goal of Buddhahood. The whole idea of the perfections is late. The story is not attested in the early strata. Okay, so maybe it's later. It depends, I guess, on what we're talking about. If we're talking about early Buddhism, I've sort of been talking about, you know, early-ish Buddhism in general. I'm not really up on how you would date, for example, the Pali Vinaya in comparison to the Jataka collection or the idea of the perfections, but I am sort of taking it as a whole. But thank you for that comment. Anagarika Michelle Raymond, are there other points in the canon where Tulananda's effectiveness is called into question? After all, she has multiple students. Are all of these students also bad, as the one mentioned today? I think usually, if I'm remembering correctly, her students are sort of referred to generically, except for Chandakali, maybe the only one that is given by name. And she is bad. She's consistently described as somebody who's always causing trouble in the Sangha. So, you know, going back to the earlier point that you made, you know, maybe it's not only that Tulananda's mastery of the external trappings is finally superficial. Maybe her effectiveness is also finally superficial. We can even see that in the fact that she, the one person really that she is said to inspire and rouse and gladden and delight with her preaching is the king. And, you know, maybe the king is kind of a superficial character who is easily swayed by external trappings as well. Tata Loka Bhikkhuni, something more about the development of the Pali Vinaya. It was very interesting to me that at the time of the Chandakali Sangadisesa story, it was apparently possible for Tulananda to convene her own assembly of nuns to restore Chandakali status. The male monks do not seem to have needed to be involved in the restoration of a Bhikkhuni status at that time. Yeah, that story is odd, right? When I first read it, I was like, wait a minute, you can't, how can you just convene your own assembly to restore someone? So I suppose, you know, all of these things one by one have to be shown to be impermissible. But yeah, you're right about the male monks. That's also interesting that there is no mention of the male monks being involved in her restoration. Thank you for that comment. Anything else? Thanks so much for this fascinating talk. Well, thank you, Liz. Nice to see you in the chat box. By the way, you know, everything I said today, in one form or another, pretty much it's all in my article. So if you didn't get a chance to read it, it's all there, and that the PDF is available on the website. Anything else? I think we can and perhaps even should draw a historical distinction between the canonical texts and the commentaries. Jataka narratives are entirely commentarial. Yes, that's very true. Even though some Vinaya narratives do incorporate Jatakas so as to properly appreciate the evolution of Buddhist thought and position particular stories or ideas within such a perspective. Yes, that is true. On the other hand, the Jataka narratives are entirely commentarial, but and were not made canonical, which is significant. But on the other hand, difficult to date, right? Surely they go back to older oral traditions, who knows how old. So, you know, I will say this. I've very often been criticized in my work for not being very historically rooted. I enjoy just taking the whole scope and mixing ideas together. And I, you know, that's the major criticism that has sometimes been made, that I am not very historically rooted. Maybe because I really believe that ideas in Buddhism are added on to each other. It seems to really get rid of nothing finally, but this thought world is kind of built up that is so intertwined in nature. But you're right, definitely. I discuss the Jataka genre in my study of the genesis of the Bodhisattva ideal, and perhaps that might be of interest to you. Yes, absolutely. If you could send me a link to that in the forum or discussion board, that would be great. Taking the whole scope and mixing ideas together is very much the contemporary reality of Buddhism. Yeah, well, so I guess, you know, in part it depends on what your purpose is. If you're trying to reconstruct history and what historically happened and when it happened, then you do have to be much more rigorous than I have ever been, frankly, in placing things into their proper historical perspective. On the other hand, that is an interesting point. What is your purpose in reading these texts at all? And I suppose from a modern monks or nuns perspective, you are sort of looking at the entirety of the literature and trying to see what you can make out of it. So thank you for that comment. Well, if there are no more questions, I think maybe we can conclude. Thank you very much. Thank you, thank you, thank you. All right. Well, thank you everyone for listening. This was sort of fun. I'm going to take a, well, I just took a screenshot so I can send it to my husband. All right. Thank you. I'm going to sign off now.